Those in the market for a mobile device or a new contract find themselves bombarded by acronyms like LTE and HSPA, and they're all part of the move to 4G. To help us better understand what this is all about, we called Rich Jaroslawski. He's technology columnist for Bloomberg News. We reached him at his office in San Francisco.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, for people who barely wrap their minds around 3G, or in fact, for people who don't have a clue what 3G is, can you tell us what 4G is, what it stands for, and what it does?
Well, 4G stands for fourth generation, and it refers to the new wireless data networks that the carriers are rolling out across the country. And all four of the major U.S. carriers have things that they're calling 4G. But in fact, the real problem is there's no standard, and some of the networks that are being rolled out are really just sort of tweaked versions of the existing data service.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that 4G is not that meaningful.
No, in fact, you could even go further and say it's meaningless at this point. What happened was that the International Telecommunications Union, which is sort of the big international standard-setting agency, set out a definition for what a 4G network was supposed to be in terms of its speed and performance. And it was ignored by the carriers, who instead embraced 4G as a marketing weapon. And late last year, the ITU essentially bowed to the inevitable and basically said anything goes. And so now, whatever the carriers choose to call 4G is being marketed as 4G.
Is there any benefit to 4G?
There is. If you are lucky enough to be in an area where there is 4G coverage and you have a 4G phone and it's a true 4G or a really new network, you will see faster data speeds. So web pages on your smartphone will load more quickly. You'll get information more quickly. There are genuine benefits to being in a true 4G environment.
What should people focus on when choosing a phone service?
I think there are a couple of things. One is coverage maps. Even the most widely deployed 4G networks are not everywhere. And so the first thing I would do would be to make sure that the area that you're going to be using your phone in actually has 4G service, because if it doesn't, what's the point? Point number two, I think I would look at is to ask the carrier, will this 4G device that you're trying to sell me right now run on your latest, most advanced network? And the answer may well be, well, not really. And then the third thing is going to be price. People on 4G networks will consume data at a faster rate than people on the older, slower networks. Therefore, if there are caps on how much data you can use and extra charges, you could find that bill mounting very quickly.
You know, just one last thing. Do you think this confusion may be turning off consumers?
I think that the more consumers understand what's going on, I think the more ticked off they're going to be. Right now, I think the carriers are doing themselves a disservice by going through this anything-goes situation.
Rich Jaroslawski is the technology columnist for Bloomberg News, speaking to us from San Francisco. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Writer and journalist Anne Royfe made her name as a voice of the women's movement. Her 1970 novel Up the Sandbox was hailed as a feminist classic. Of late, Royfe's been writing memoirs on such topics as marriage and old age. Her latest memoir, Art and Madness, is a fierce recollection of her youth in the literary New York of the 1950s and early 60s. The memoir includes an introduction by Royfe's well-known writer daughter, Katie. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Towards the end of her ego-shredding new memoir called Art and Madness, Anne Royfe tells the jaw-dropping story of the day her first child was born. It was 1960, and a snowstorm was raging in New York City. Royfe, 9 months pregnant, has shuffled over to Third Avenue to a repair store to pick up her husband's typewriter. That husband, a playwright named Jack Richardson, is snug at home, sleeping off a night out on the town. Roifey wants him to have his typewriter nearby, should inspiration strike when he awakens. So she picks it up at the store, balances its weight against her swollen belly, and starts trudging through the snow 15 blocks back to their apartment. On the way, her water breaks. She reaches a payphone and calls her husband. He doesn't wake up to answer. No taxis are around, so Roifey stumbles on, all the way to the hospital, typewriter clasped like a religious relic in her arms. I say that anecdote is jaw-dropping because it is, viewed through the feminist-inflected lens of 2011. But here's how powerful a writer that masochistic young woman came to be. Because even as we contemporary readers may be tisk-tisking over Roifey's martyrdom, she also transports us deep into the mindset of a handmaiden of literature circa 1960. Reading that passage, I was anxious at the thought of Roifey going into labor in a snowdrift. But because of the way Roifey draws me into the scene, I was simultaneously anxious about that damn typewriter and wondering if maybe she shouldn't have dropped it off with the doorman at her apartment house for safekeeping before she lumbered on alone to the hospital. Art and Madness is a particularly hard-boiled addition to a distinct subgenre of female autobiography. Memoirs written by women who came of age in the 1950s and who sublimated their own ambitions by attaching themselves to literary men. I'm thinking of testaments like How I Became Hetty Jones by the eponymous former wife of Leroy Jones, later Amiri Baraka, Manhattan When I Was Young by Mary Cantwell, and the especially magnificent Minor Characters by Joyce Johnson, one-time girlfriend of Jack Kerouac. Educated at Seven Sisters Colleges or their like, these young women wanted to live for art, which in the 1950s translated into living for a man who thought of himself as an artist. They found a place for themselves in the New York boho scene of the time, pouring drinks or tending to the other appetites of the resident drunken geniuses. Roifey, who married right after graduating from Sarah Lawrence and was divorced from her playwright about 6 years later, was a smart party girl in the Norman Mailer, George Plimpton literary lion pack. Analyzing the marriage of Doc Humes, who co-founded the Paris Review, and his wife, Roifey coldly illuminates the 1950s allure of the great man. He was a writer, a famous writer, with famous writer friends, and that made him special, far more appealing than a banker or a lawyer. He was an artist, and she would bear his children and wash his clothes and care for him, because there lay her own immortality. There lay her own contribution to the great effort to speak the truth, to shape the words, to write the novel that by existing would justify the human endeavor. I know this because I felt it too, all of it. Art and Madness is presented in shards of memories, mostly dating from the 1950s and early 60s. Roifey evokes the limited courage of her younger self. She was gutsy enough as a college girl to drive alone into New York, to perch herself on bar stools at writers' hangouts like the West End, but not yet brave enough to respect her own talent. What especially sets Art and Madness apart from its autobiographical sorority sisters is its mercilessness. After Roifey describes her husband leaving her for good, she says, "I have no pity for her, the still young woman helping her fleeing husband pack his shirts into a suitcase. I have no pity for that about-to-be-divorced woman who had been ready to live off the written words of someone else." Searing words that attest to the courage Roifey eventually did discover in herself, thanks in part to the Second Women's Movement. And yet, reading Roifey's tough comments, I can't help but feel that she's still lugging around more than her share of the historical burden.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Art and Madness by Anne Royfe. Coming up, we remember composer Hugh Martin, who died last week. This is Fresh Air.